What if the future of whole nations were decided by only 40 to 50 people in a tight-knit group right at the very top of society? That was the basic idea of one of the thinkers that you've probably never heard of that I'm covering on this Great Thinker series, Maurice Cowling. He was a historian. He is famous for two books, The Impact of Labour and The Impact of Hitler. But he also wrote many other books as well. And he was known as being something of an arch conservative. And you can have a look at him there. One of the key ideas that he had, as I've already mentioned, is that high politics, and what he calls high politics, is really the realm of the inner circle around the leaders of the country. But high politics is the decisive arena. Real power resides with 50 or 60 individuals at most, operating through personal relationships, parliamentary maneuvering, and private conversation. Mass movements matter only insofar as this very tight-knit elite interprets, exploits, or neutralizes them. The historian's task is to reconstruct the calculations within this narrow political nation and not to treat politics as a mere reflection of social or economic forces. And one of the things, just to bring myself back up again, that he shows very deftly in these two books was just how few people were instrumental in, for example, the rise of the Labour Party and those early governments there in the 1920s. And in this book, the decision to take Great Britain to war against Germany, against Hitler, namely Churchill and a few other small group of war hawks. And he traces both of those things, and he's very, very convincing in showing that almost no factors outside what those people did really mattered. He also argues that all history is polemical. The modern claim to scholarly neutrality is either naive or a form of concealment. Every historical account is shaped by the author's assumptions, sympathies, and his purposes. This does not make the study of history worthless. It simply demands that readers approach historical writing with the same critical rigor they would to any other form of argument, and that historians cease pretending otherwise. And I think one of the ways to bring this home is to imagine a history of the last 10 years written by an ardent Donald Trump supporter, for example, or an ardent enemy of Trump or a critic of Trump. And see how different those two histories, over the past decade in American life, American politics, would look. What Cowling is saying is that basically everybody always has been engaged in this game of treating history as a kind of a polemical tool to push certain agendas, to push certain ideas. History is never neutral. And what is interesting about Cowling, because this idea is also found on the left, especially in the work of a historian called Hayden White. He wrote a book called Meta History, where he made largely the same point. Over here, of course, Thomas Carlyle also had it in for the Dryer's Dust antiquarian historian, and he tended to see history as being alive, and also history as being a kind of staging ground for polemical and moral arguments. So Cowling connects with both, his view of history here is reflected both on, the reactionary right as embodied by someone like Carlyle, and on the postmodern left after Hayden White. He actually agreed with all of those people in his own idiosyncratic way. Cowling argued that we should treat progressive narratives with skepticism, that much 20th century historiography functions as ideological scaffolding for contemporary liberal politics, presenting the past as a story of inevitable progress, inevitable enlightenment and expanding rights, almost as if the purpose of the past is as a kind of path towards a progressive future. And this, and again, both sides are guilty of this. Obviously, there's the progressive left-wing civil rights history that everybody's familiar with, that all of history bends towards Martin Luther King, something like this. But there is also a liberal, classical liberal, or even conservative version of this idea, namely Whig history, that sees bygone times as one long narrative, one long path towards scientific enlightenment and this sort of thing. Okay, so that's both Whig history, prosperity, in this narrative, the development of free markets is seen as an advance on feudalism, for example. So these are both progressive versions of history. And what Carling is saying is all of these progressive narratives must be treated with skepticism. Seeing the past as a story of inevitable enlightenment is a mistake. Carling argued that narratives like these distort the historical record in order to legitimate present-day moral and political ends. In other words, he warned against presentism. The result of all of this is ideology dressed in scholarly garb rather than genuine inquiry. And he argues that the task of the historian really is to try to get inside what's going on in high politics to get a real insight into what was actually happening at the time, rather than looking at mass movements, and also rather than looking at these grand narratives of progress that are used to justify this, that, or the other. He says the political nation is the proper object of analysis. He rejected the idea that there were class interests as a primary, he didn't say that classes didn't exist. What he said is that unlike Marxist class struggle as the engine room of history, class interests are not the primary political drivers. They do not dictate outcomes. He also rejected public opinion as a direct and autonomous political force, and broad social movements. So, what happened in this era or that era is seldom the result of mass organization or mass public sentiment, anything like that. He insisted that politics is driven by specific individuals who held or sought office, the networks, the specific networks they belong to, the strategies that they employed. Popular sentiment mattered chiefly as a resource to be managed or an obstacle to be overcome by the governing few. Now, if you've been following my previous videos, or if you've read my work on elite theory, you can see why Maurice Cowling is a figure of interest, because even though he does not directly cite Mosca or Pareto, he may have had some influence from Pareto indirectly, which we'll come to soon. You can see that his basic frame of looking at politics, looking at history, is elitist. He's saying it is the small, in fact, not even the non-governing elite that Mosca pointed to, but the very, very top cloister, the top 50 people, right at the nip of the triangle, those are the relevant players at a particular moment. And his work really focuses on the individual, almost day-to-day level machinations between those players. Okay. He also, as a result of this particularity in the analysis, it's these individuals, it's this network group that's causing the real change top down. Therefore, political science is largely an illusion. In this view, he was strongly influenced by the conservative philosopher Michael Oakeshott, who was a contemporary of Cowling's. They were probably friends of some sort. Cowling argued that politics is a practical, contingent, and historical activity irreducible to abstract laws or technical methods. Now, I should note here that his rejection of political science was not a rejection of elite theory or elite analysis, okay? Because all of those guys, Mosca, Pareto, Michels, you know, had pretensions towards calling themselves capital S science. But that's not really who he had in mind here. In fact, his own method of looking at the top level, at looking at the elite, was influenced indirectly by Pareto through a man called Lewis Namier, who was a profound influence on Cowling in his early career. But so really, he wasn't attacking the elite theorists. He had in mind, Cowling, rationalistic, progressive, liberal views of history, and also socialist traditions, mainly Marxism, that tried to reduce politics to universal theories like class struggle, to scientistic procedures, and to detachable rules. His target was the pretension that politics could be made fully scientific, not the close study of political elites themselves. So all of his work looks at elites. And at some level, you could argue that Cowling is positing a theory of how societies work from the top down, although given his distaste for abstraction, he never quite phrases it in that way, but it is implicit in the way that he approaches history. Real political knowledge is acquired through experiences, tradition, and immersion in particular practices. There is no shortcuts through theory. And what he's saying is, like, look, you can study these political science all you want. Political science is not going to explain why it was that Winston Churchill declared war on Germany in 1939, or why it was that Churchill and his friends were so hell-bent on getting Britain involved in wars. Or it's not going to explain the specific manner in which Labour entered Parliament, entered politics in the 1920s. Yes, there were mass movements. Yes, there were strikes and so on and so forth, Labour movements, but that does not explain the parliamentary Labour Party and specifically what went on there in the 20s, the deals that were made, the accommodations that were made, the networks that are involved, the money men behind the scenes. Even if you fast forward to the current day, you could say that the recent announcement of Keir Starmer's resignation was not as the result of mass discontent at Keir Starmer. It was not even as the result of bottom-up movements within the party. It was the result of specific Machiavellian machinations of individual members of Starmer's cabinet and Andy Burnham and people like Angela Rayner, all working in concert behind the scenes. And even beyond that, Cowling would have been like, well, what was somebody like Lord Mandelson involved as revenge? Was Tony Blair involved? Who was Gordon Brown involved? Was Ed Miliband involved? All of these individual players in the game, was the US president Donald Trump involved? Was who else, were certain money men involved? Was this a decision taken by Larry Fink at BlackRock? He would have gone into all of those and said, actually, these are the things that dictated ultimately the fate of Starmer, not the public's discontent with him. He's been the most unpopular prime minister, for the past 2 years. So I'm just trying to give you a flavor of what Cowling is demanding of the honest historian who really wants to get the answer. And he's saying, like, you're not going to be able to get there through any abstract theory. Ideas in politics are rarely disinterested, is the next big idea of Cowling's. And he says that even apparently high-minded philosophical arguments are shaped by immediate political circumstances and the ambitions of those who employ them. Now, I would argue that this idea of cowlings is one that we have come across before when I covered Pareto, and I did say Pareto is indirectly hovering in the background here. I have phrased this before as BS, 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 so therefore we rule. But what he's saying is ideas are important, okay? We can't, we can't diminish the importance of ideas. They're very effective weapons, but those ideas must be analyzed in relation to the concrete struggles in which they appear and should not be treated as timeless expressions of truth. That is, you should always ask if a particular prime minister or government or party is starting to evoke abstract ideas, or certain thinkers, or if certain thinkers come into vogue, or if people start, if the media starts going on about somebody a lot, you must always ask, what else is going on here? Why are they doing this? What is the real interest here that this thinker or that thinker is now being evoked again? Okay, I've often likened it to picking somebody off the shelf. Okay, imagine you are running the British Empire and you want to justify why this trade barrier needs to be broken down, or why Ghana or some other country, you name a colony, why the Gold Coast, why India need to specialize in this raw material or that raw material. And so you look at your shelf, you say, well, Adam Smith, he gives some good reasons for that. So we also want to do David Ricardo. He seems pretty good. Who's this Nassau fella? You know, and then those arguments were not actually dictating the policy. The causality is the other way around. They wanted to do this and they needed a theory to justify it. And this more or less is what Cowling is saying, that big abstract ideals and ideas often reveal a more sectional interest or in a more particular interest. So you could say, well, look at all of the arguments that somebody like Tony Blair puts forwards for, you know, digital ID or the adoption of AI technology. And he will present these in neutral terms and in abstract terms and in universal terms as being, you know, goods, as being unallied goods that we need to embrace in the name of progress, something like this. But Cowling would say, hold on a second, let's have a look at Blair's network. He's working very closely with Larry Ellison. He has a lot of friends in tech. He also is very attracted to the notion of surveillance overall. So what is it that Tony Blair really wants? Does he want to advance mankind through these technologies, okay, in the name of some big abstract ideal? Or is he advancing specific moneyed interests? And is he also advancing specific power nodes and their ability to survey and surveil the public? These are the sorts of ways that Cowling would start approaching the question. Tell you what, folks, it's getting very hot here. Feel a little bit of a sale coming on. Let's just interrupt this broadcast to bring you news of the latest sale at the academic agency. And you've guessed it, folks, it's promo code Scorcher. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Scorcher. Get it now. Scorcher. 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 Promo code Scorcher. 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 Buy it now. Well, one can only imagine the eyebrow that Cowling would raise at that advert. But yes, pick up my courses. They do stack with all the bundles, the Ultra Bundle, the Mega Bundle. You'll get whatever you want. I'll get you 25% off. Buy it now. Now, let's get back to the lecture at hand here, because Cowling was a conservative and he saw himself in what is known as the High Tory tradition. He was a traditionalist with a deep attachment to order, custom, inherited practice, rooted in political wisdom accumulated over time. He was also combative, and he said that conservatives need a kind of fighting spirit. They must be unsentimental, and thus they must be willing to fight from the level of first principle. They must be willing to subject liberal pieties and progressive moralism to rigorous, acerbic, unflinching critique without apology. And this is something that Cowling did in some of his later works. One of them is a critique, I believe, of John Stuart Mill, one of his more famous theoretical works. A little bit later on, some of his work is of a slightly more religious bent, but it's very much from this conservative traditionalist point of view, pointing out all of the flaws with abstract liberal ideas. And I think Cowling, you know, he's British, he's from a very British strand of Toryism, is a thinker that people need to spend more time getting to know, which is why I've made this video. He's also unflinching, refusing to evade uncomfortable realities about power, about ambition, about human nature in the name of decency or good taste. Cowling detected a lot of cowardice in a lot of conservatives who want nothing more than to get on with people, to be respectable, to have a quiet life. And Cowling, you know, rejected this kind of polite tea with a vicar sort of conservatism. He wanted to bring the fight to the liberals a little bit more. He says contingency explains more than grand theory. And in The Impact of Labour, this book that I have here, he actually demonstrates a good bit of this in practice. And one of the cool things about Cowling is that it's always grounded in real things, real situations, things that actually happened, real people making real decisions. In a way, you know, Ludwig von Mises talks about human action. Cowling is always bringing it back to actual human action, these specific people taking specific decisions. And so he wants to look at character, that is the personal traits shaping the choices and the influence of somebody's allies. For example, if we come back to Winston Churchill, okay, the character of Churchill is fundamental to understanding what he actually did. The fact that he was in debt, the fact that he liked to have a drink, the fact that he had an expensive cigar habit, all highly relevant details for understanding what it was that Churchill actually did, okay, in history. If you want to fast forward it into more recent times, the fact that Boris Johnson, okay, is a man of low moral fiber who changes his opinions quite easily, okay, there had a certain predictive power in what he then actually did in office, being known as one of the great betrayers in conservative history, for example. Circumstances are also very important. Timing and context amplify or constrain options. There are certain things, options available at certain times, and those options are no longer on the table, even a year later or 2 years later, even 6 months later. And then there are decisions, specific choices made, and the chances to produce outcomes. Ultimately, people have to make decisions. Okay, and basically what you're doing in history is you're analyzing how character and circumstance go into the making of decisions, and then what is the impact of those specific decisions? Were they good ones? Were they bad ones? You know, you can have hindsight, and this is his way of approaching what actually happened in history. He also argues that historians must impute motive. They must look into why it was certain people did certain things at certain times. What were they actually trying to achieve? Even when their public statement said one thing, do private correspondences reveal another thing? Cowling drew on diaries, speeches, private correspondences, letters to expose the strategic ambitious and sometimes deliberately deceptive character of political actors. Bland neutrality, he argued, produces evasion rather than objectivity. So this is the historian in a way as detective, but these things are highly relevant to understanding what it was that happened. And again, if you want to bring it up to the modern day, historians in the future will ask of Keir Starmer, what was it that he knew about Lord Mandelson when? Why did he lie to the public? What were the specific constraints on him acting at that time? Why was he dishonest in those moments? Why did he try to cling on at this moment and this moment and this moment? Why was it the Andy Burnham situation in Makerfield that finally pushed Starmer over the edge? And these are questions that the Maurice Cowling of the future will seek to answer through this sort of work, through things that come to the public to light, through, you know, release of diaries, through release of information that we didn't have before. Let's say Lord Mandelson dies at some point and his estate reveals his private diaries. You know, that would be a gold mine to the future Maurice Cowling. Finally, liberalism tends towards moral regulation. Cowling detected within much 20th century liberalism an impulse to reshape society according to abstract moral and rational principles, at the expense of tradition, at the expense of custom, and at the expense of individual liberty. So even though he was, you know, a traditionalist conservative, Cowling was also one of those who wanted to go back to conditions prior to 1913, where an Englishman truly was free. This tendency of liberalism to regulate morality, he argued, is potentially totalitarian in character. However benevolently it presents itself, initially, its tendency is towards tyranny. And Cowling's entire body of work stands as a sustained warning against the intellectual and moral overreach of the modern liberal project. Now remember, Cowling was writing in the 1960s and prior to that, in the mid-20th century. He did not live to see the excesses of political correctness, of so-called social justice warriors, of the woke, of the various overreaches of the discrimination laws, prejudice laws, racial quotas, gender quotas. All of these are tendencies towards moral regulation. And he says that the seeds of this totalitarian tendency are actually always there within the abstract ideals of liberalism, that as long as liberalism is the engine, the idea engine of the prevailing order, this tendency is always going to keep on coming back again. He saw it in John Stuart Mill and in kind of 19th century utilitarianism. He saw it in the liberals of his own time. And anybody watching this will have seen it in the liberals around them. So maybe you are a liberal and you strongly have that impetus towards moral regulation yourself. But of course, Cowling was against it in the name of the ancient freedom of the Briton. So there it is, a thinker that you've never heard of, a very interesting thinker. If you've heard of Maurice Cowling, you were part of a very small elect group of people. Now, that group of people, hopefully with this video, will be bigger. Let me know which other thinkers you'd like covered on this Greatest Thinker series. I've got a whole plan of these and I'm rolling them out. But as we go forward, they will expand more and more. So if you have particular people you'd like to see, and I prefer ones that aren't like super well known. So like Maurice Cowling, not super well known, but super interesting. Those are the sorts of figures that I would love to cover. I've got a plan of, roughly speaking, these weeks are loosely themed. All of the thinkers will have a reason for being grouped in the four. But as I'm planning future videos, I'd love to know who else you'd like me to cover. Promo code Scorcher gets 25% off all courses. Buy it now. Trivium, of course. You can get all the courses on the Ultra Bundle. Many others available. But most importantly of all, friends, guess out.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.